Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the candidate of the Green Party and the Socialist Party for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that me and my running mate, Angela Walker, ran on in 2020. So top of the news right now is this renewal of the Israeli-Palestine war. And both sides are fighting again. And I don't think it really matters who broke the truce. The fact is Israel's overwhelming power is creating devastation in Gaza. And now they're targeting southern Gaza communities who the Israelis told Gazans to move to. And now they put out QR codes for finding these little islands that are supposed to be safe. But the problem is there's no electricity and no internet connection in Gaza. So how are people going to find these supposed islands of safety? In Israel, it's clear they're pushing Gazans further south toward Egypt, which is the goal of the far right that's in power in Israel. They want to expel or kill Palestinians living anywhere in historic Palestine. The expansion, the attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank continue as well. So this is a situation we got to keep demanding a ceasefire and beyond that, moving to a political solution. And the U.S. has a lot of leverage here. You know, it's been backing Israel diplomatically, militarily for decades with few, if any, conditions. And the Palestinians get money from, you know, the PA gets money from the Palestinian Authority, gets money from the U.S. So U.S. has leverage here, and what I think it's going to require to get to a political solution, negotiations that are serious, is going to require new elections on both sides. And as I've explained before on this podcast, that Hamas got disproportionate seats in the Palestinian National Council as a result of the winner-take-all district elections that were part of the elections in 2006. The fact is, the polls show that neither Fatah or Hamas has a lot of support among Palestinians as a whole. So they need a representative government, which proportional representation elections could provide. And then on the Israeli side, I mean, Netanyahu, the only thing keeping him in power right now is the war. There are demonstrations as we speak going on, demanding his resignation. Some of the families of hostages are saying, stop the war, go back to negotiations. Israel pulled its negotiators out of Qatar. So it's a bad situation. So there's going to be a lot of activities on the streets, and I hope people will be out there demanding a ceasefire. And I think when we talk about a one-state or a two-state solution or a confederation, I think that's secondary. You know, whether it's one state, two states, or a confederation, it has to be based, the solution has to be based on dismantling occupation and apartheid and providing and enforcing equal rights for all. And it's going to take the international community, and particularly the U.S., to pressure both sides to engage in genuine negotiations toward a political solution. So that's what we need to be pushing while this carnage goes on. And the other big international thing this week is the UN Climate Conference, COP28, began. And we had a surprise the first day. The Loss and Damage Fund, which was authorized at COP27 last year in Egypt, was made operational on the first day of the COP28 this year, which is in the United Arab Emirates. And countries started pledging money. You know, Biden's climate envoy, John Kerry, had told Congress last July that, quote unquote, under no circumstances would the U.S. pay climate reparations for its historical emissions of greenhouse gases. And that's what the Loss and Damage Fund, it's considered climate reparations for loss and damage from climate disasters and damage. But Kerry and the U.S. had to capitulate because even the host petro state, the United Arab Emirates, and the EU led by Germany were insisting that they start funding the Loss and Damage Fund. So the UAE and Germany each pledged 100 million. The UK pledged 75 million. The EU combined pledged 245 million. But the US only committed a paltry 17.5 million, for which it's been widely criticized. So the total initial funding is about 430 million. And the estimates of what's needed annually is over 400 billion a year. So they have 1 year funded. We'll have to see if the funding continues in future years. There's also been a green climate fund that was established in 2009 at COP15 in Copenhagen. And its purpose was to minimize emissions and build resilience in the poorer countries, the global south, through renewable energy development. And it was supposed to be raising $100 billion a year by 2020. But by 2020, it had only raised $10 billion. And the U.S. had pledged $1 billion under Obama, but only $1 billion was actually sent because Trump came in and stopped payments at the same time he withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 Paris COP climate agreement. So earlier this year, Biden announced that the U.S. would contribute $1 billion to the Green Climate Fund, and that brought the total since for the last 15 years to just $2 billion. Remember, they want $100 billion per year. And today, Vice President Kamala Harris announced the U.S. will put in $3 billion to the Green Climate Fund next year. But $3 billion is still well below the U.S. share of historic emissions, which is 25% of all emissions. So we're still not contributing what we should. Now, there are a number of other items on the agenda for this COP28. One is to either, quote unquote, phase down or, quote unquote, phase out the use of fossil fuels. That's a big debate in the language, whether to say that coal has to be phased out, not just phased down. Whether to make a commitment to triple renewable energy capacity by 2030, whether to commit to phasing out fossil fuel subsidies, which totaled $7 trillion globally last year. $7 trillion, and we're talking here about tens of billions or a few billions or even millions for the loss and damage fund. The fossil fuel industry is getting $7 trillion a year. So that's on the agenda. And then the other thing is whether to support climate capture and removal technology, which is largely unproven. Not on the agenda is increasing the commitments countries have to greenhouse gas emission reductions. If the current pledges are implemented, which come from the Paris conference, and that's a big question, global temperatures will still rise 2.5 degrees Celsius. It's 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit, according to the International Panel on Climate Change estimates. And actual policies in place, which the pledges, you know, haven't been implemented, will increase temperatures by 2.9 degrees Celsius or 5 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a disaster. That's just a total disaster for the planet. And meanwhile, on the sidelines of this supposed climate summit, the big oil and gas companies and the big oil and gas producing and consuming countries are cutting deals. They're using this as an occasion to carry forward the fossil fuel business, which I've, as I explained in a past podcast, that the U.S. and many countries around the world are going to continue increasing fossil fuel production. And in 2030, it'll be greater than it has ever been. Now, this summit is hosted by a petrostate, the United Arab Emirates, and presided over their Sultan Al Jaber, who is also happens to be the CEO of the UAE state-owned Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. It's like putting a fox in charge of the chicken house. So, you know, the basic picture is we can't accept what the U.S. and other world leaders are doing about climate. We got to keep pushing for an eco-socialist solution, a global Green New Deal, to rapidly build out 100% clean energy and zero emissions in the world economy. Now, China accounts for 30% of current world emissions, the EU 17%, and the US 14%. That's a total of 61% of all global emissions today. Now, together, these three powers could lead the energy transition. And it is encouraging that when the US and China, you know, Xi Jinping was out there in California, they pledged to work together to triple clean energy production in the world by 2030, which is one of the items on the COP agenda this year. But that should just be the beginning. And we have to make sure that this expansion of clean energy doesn't just add to existing energy production, which is fossil fuel based, but replaces the fossil fuels. And that's not what's been happening as renewables have been growing, particularly because they're so cheap. So we got to monitor what they do and not just what they say. So I think the bottom line for us is we have to keep building the climate movement and putting pressure on the U.S. government. And unfortunately, most of the well-funded NGO climate groups are giving their support to Biden without making any demands. So Biden feels little pressure from the climate movement and is taking their support for granted, because climate voters certainly aren't going to go vote for Trump and the Republicans. And that's why we need the Green Party to make stronger demands and at least make the Democrats compete for the climate vote. So that's bad news. Now, I was at a panel on Tuesday at New York University called What is Marxism For? And one of the things that came out of the discussion, which I wanted to share with you, was the difference between New Deal liberalism and New Left socialism, which I think is something our so-called democratic socialist left today has lost. I mean, at best, these democratic socialists are promoting New Deal liberalism, you know, those types of programs. It's not about socializing the means of production. It's about government programs to provide goods and services. So they've lost the New Left's critique of the New Deal type programs, which were centralized top down in delivering public goods and services. And that creates a lot of problems. And the New Left, with its themes of participatory democracy and community control, put forward bottom-up socialist and democratized policies for delivering public goods and services like housing, healthcare, and energy. So I wanted to share that discussion with you. So what we have today, what dominates, is neoliberalism. When public services are provided, as stingy as neoliberalism funds those things, they're mostly outsourced to private contractors, even the military. Now, New Deal liberalism, you know, had public agencies delivering these public goods and services, but it was very centralized and top down, easier for capture by industries that were affected by these policies, and unaccountable to communities. So a lot of times those services weren't provided to people that needed them most. And one of the problems with New Deal programs is they continued the segregation thanks to the influence of the Dixiecrats in the Senate. And so the New Left critique of old New Deal liberal programs proposed decentralized bottom-up administration of the delivery of public goods and services. You know, under those themes from the New Left of participatory democracy and community control. But most progressives today in the movements and in Congress are advocating what they think are kind of New Deal liberal programs, but they're really neoliberal reforms where tax incentives and subsidies and outsourcing in private markets are used to promote public goods like affordable housing, healthcare, and climate protection. So they aren't even New Deal liberals in advocating these public programs that directly deliver public services, which the New Deal did. In fact, the only real New Deal type program that progressives today still advocate is national health insurance, or what we call Medicare for All. But from the perspective of New Left socialism coming out of the 1960s, Medicare for All is not enough. It only socializes the insurance payment system, but not the healthcare delivery system. So I think it's important for us as eco-socialists today to recover the New Left Socialist Alternative to New Deal Liberalism. And so let me, you know, fill that out a little bit by looking at housing, healthcare, and energy policy. So the New Deal policy for affordable housing was public housing, the direct provision of affordable housing by public agencies. But what we've turned to since really it began under Johnson and was consolidated under Nixon and even strengthened under Clinton is providing public incentives to private developers for affordable housing. And then vouchers, Section 8 vouchers, to give poor people an opportunity to buy in the private rental market. And this began under Johnson, where housing vouchers and these subsidies for private developers were first introduced. And Nixon, you know, really consolidated that with a moratorium on new public housing construction and the Section 8 voucher program, which was much expanded from what Johnson had. And in Clinton, you know, this didn't change under Carter or Reagan or the first Bush. Clinton really closed the door on new public housing with the Faircloth Amendment, which he supported. It passed Congress, and that capped the number of public housing units there could be in the U.S. to what existed at that time in 1999. You know, what's been happening is we've been losing public housing units. There have been a provision, and this was repealed by the Clinton administration, that you had to have a one-to-one replacement for projects that were demolished. You had to replace other public housing units. Clinton got rid of that too. Now, a New Left affordable housing policy in line with the New Deal approach would build out public housing until every person in the U.S. had access to affordable housing unit. And that's something we should support. And what that would mean is an increase from about 1% of all units today are public housing to 20% or 30%, like many countries in Western Europe have. And what that does is not only make more public housing that's affordable available to people, but it also makes the private market compete with those public housing rents, which brings down rents across the board. But what a New Left socialist affordable housing policy would also do is democratize the administration of the program with elected tenant councils overseeing the administration of local public housing agencies. So the missing piece from a New Left perspective is, you know, worker and community control of the delivery of that public good housing. Let's look at energy. Now, our Eco Socialist Green New Deal called for public ownership and planning in key industries, energy, transportation, and heavy manufacturing, in order to coordinate a rapid 10-year transition to 100% clean energy and zero greenhouse gas emissions. But what we're getting with the climate actions or policies from Biden and the Democrats, including these, most of these, you know, Green New Deal for schools and Green New Deals for housing, are public tax incentives and subsidies to private corporations to build parts of a clean energy and housing and transportation system. And that's the neoliberal approach, contracting out the delivery of these public goods and services to private industry. And it's hit or miss. You know, private corporations do what they do is up to them. They are still in charge, and they will do the right thing only if it's profitable. And subsidies and tax incentives are no guarantee that it will be. I mean, there's a problem right now with offshore wind because of profitability issues, which is a complicated question. I won't go into the details all. But the point is there's no overall plan to build out this renewable energy system to get to zero greenhouse gas emissions. Now, our Green New Deal approach, you know, the New Deal liberalism, would set up a public agency to carry out the program. And let's just look at one small piece. The idea of a civilian climate corps has been put forward, particularly it's a big issue for the Sunrise Movement, modeled on the Civilian Conservation Corps of the New Deal. But what we have is not what the Civilian Conservation Corps was, which was a public agency, a federal agency that had an overall plan, and it hired people as public employees to carry out the projects in that plan. What we have with the Civilian Climate Corps, which Biden announced in September and called the American Climate Corps, What we have there is privatized. It's administered by AmeriCorps, which also runs the Peace Corps and that domestic counterpart. And what it's going to do is take project proposals from NGOs and local governments, issue grants, and then the workers are hired by the NGOs or local governments. So there's no overall planning. There's a whole new bureaucracy of grant writers, grant reviewers, grant administrators, which, you know, takes up a lot of the resources. And it means that disadvantaged communities that don't have the middle-class professionals who can navigate this grants bureaucracy are going to be left out. And so, you know, it's just ironic that, you know, the groups that are the most militant and active, like the Sunrise Movement, are pushing a neoliberal approach, not even a New Deal approach, although I think they think they are. I don't think they recognize that this American Climate Corps is a regression from the New Deal's Civilian Conservation Corps. And then, you know, look at the issue of public power. You know, that was not controversial in the progressive area. Well, it was controversial, but we got a lot of municipal power to utilities in the progressive era, and the New Deal did some of that, like with the Tennessee Valley Authority. And when we had the energy crisis in 1974, the Arab oil boycott during the Israeli-Arab War that started in late 1973, there was a lot of talk for nationalizing the oil and utility industry by New Deal Democrats at the time, even, you know, Cold War hawks like Henry Jackson. So it was a lively issue, and the New Left came up with a model. And we talked about it in the anti-nuclear movement and what we then called the Safe Energy Movement for renewables. And what it did was not only nationalize the oil and utility industries, but brought them under democratic management by communities and workers in those industries. So people associated with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., developed a New Left democratic model for a public energy system in 1974. You can go to the congressional record of December 18th, 1974, and you will see draft legislation for a public energy system in Vermont that was posted there by Senator Lee Metcalf, a Democrat from Montana at the time. And that model was written up in a couple books. One was called New Energy, Understanding the Crisis, and the Guide to an Alternative Energy System by James Ridgway and Bettina Connor. And then James Ridgway followed up in 1979 with another book called Energy Efficient Community Planning. And the model for a public energy system was a New Left model of bottom-up democratic socialism. Its goals were affordable power, energy efficiency, and building out renewables. But it was governed by local public energy districts. Their boards were elected by the public, and those district boards in turn elected a state energy board. In the Vermont model, in the national model, the state energy board would not only take control of the electric distribution and generation utilities, but also set up a state fuels corporation to buy wholesale and then sell to retailers gas, oil, and coal. And, you know, home heating fuel and things like that. And that was a big issue because prices were rising, and there was a lot of evidence at the time and concern that the price rises weren't only because of the Arab oil boycott, but because the monopolistic big oil companies were using that opportunity to jack up prices. So this would have brought price controls and provided those fuels at cost to local retailers. In the national model, the public energy district local boards would then elect regional boards, and they envisioned 10 multi-state regions, which the federal government already uses to administer federal programs. And the regional boards would in turn elect a national public energy board, which would focus on planning and research and development and managing the socialized oil and gas sector that, you know, the big oil and gas companies, until fossil fuels were phased out as renewables were phased in. So this is, you know, the New Left model was a much more direct democracy than the New Deal model, which at best could be called indirect democracy because a nationalized corporation would be controlled by the president, or a utility, like the TVA. I mean, the TVA board is appointed by the president with the consent of the Senate. So it's very top down, very removed from the people using the system. And, you know, we had a bill here in New York, and this is an example of how the new Democratic socialists have kind of lost what the New Deal, New Left offered. We had a bill called the New York Utility Democracy Act, which would have socialized the electric distribution system under democratically elected boards. And that was great. The Democratic leadership, however, wouldn't go for that in the state legislature. So what we got instead was a watered down Build Public Renewables Act. But it's lemon socialism. It lets the existing New York Power Authority build publicly owned wind and solar, but only when private industry doesn't want to do it at a given site. The original Build Public Renewables Act would have given the New York Power Authority the authority to build on any site on its own initiative. But again, the Democratic leadership wasn't having that, so it was watered down so that New York Power Authority can only step in when private industry says, we're not interested because we can't make a profit. So what we've got is a neoliberal model of building renewables by private developers and distribution of power by mostly private utilities. Although we do have, and this is a legacy of the progressive era, 50 municipal power companies and the New York Power Authority, which is a legacy of the New Deal. But we only get, or NYPA, the New York Power Authority, only gets to build public renewables when the market fails. So the New Deal model of development by NYPA was defeated, and the New Left model of democratic public utilities was also defeated. That was the utility democracy, what did I call it? The New York Utilities Democracy Act. And so what we're left with is this neoliberal model, but DSA and the other reformers in New York are touting this watered down neoliberal Build Public Renewables Act as a big victory. And all I can say is we got to raise our expectations, as Ralph Nader often tells us. And then finally, let me go through healthcare, which may be the most interesting because the Medicare for All proposal is still on the table from progressives in Congress and the movements. You know, in the 1970s, we had a big debate on three models. One was Nixon Care. Another was which was employer mandates, which we got with Obamacare. Another was national health insurance. That was the Kennedy bill, what we call today Medicare for All. And then a bill from Ron Dellums called the United States Health Service Act. That was a national health service model. And this whole debate was stimulated by healthcare inflation and the persistence of about a fifth of the population still being uninsured, as well as many underserved disadvantaged communities not having medical facilities, even after the passage not that long ago, 1965, of Medicare and Medicaid. So the conservative neoliberal model was the Nixon plan. It had employer mandates. It federalized, actually, Medicaid. It called it another name. And that was for the poor and uninsured, much more expansive than Medicaid as we know it. But Obamacare adopted this neoliberal model in a much more conservative form. Nixon's employer mandate was much stronger than we have under Obamacare. And the Medicaid-type program under Nixon was federalized. What happened under Obamacare is it's up to the states if they want to expand Medicaid with federal funding initially, but not for the long term. The Nixon plan was, you know, federally funded, administered by the states, but the feds funded it. And what we have in Medicaid today and after Obamacare, we still have is shared funding between the states and the federal government, which is why these conservative states don't want to expand Medicare. So that was the conservative neoliberal model. The liberal New Deal model was national health insurance. And so that's public payment, but still private delivery of healthcare. And the New Left criticized national health insurance as, quote unquote, the great leap sideways. and they were concerned that private interests would feed at the public trough, undermining cost control. And we see that today, even within Medicare, with Medicare Advantage or Medicare Disadvantage, as we like to call it, which, according to a recent study, cost Medicare an extra $140 billion from overcharging for services last year. And then because it's privately delivered, profit would come before patient care. And really, that's what we've seen. That critique was made in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and it panned out. So what the radical New Left model was Ron Dellums. He was a representative from the East Bay in California for a national health service, and it would socialize and democratize the delivery as well as the payment for healthcare. So hospitals and clinics would be publicly owned, healthcare providers would be public employees, and profit is taken out of the system. So it's not an old New Deal style top-down centralized bureaucracy. It was, as laid out in the legislation, it's a four-tiered federation of healthcare authorities. At the grassroots level, it is the community health authority. So that would represent 25,000 to 50,000 people overseeing a community health center for outpatient care. And the board would be elected every 2 years when we have federal elections, congressional elections. One third would be elected by the healthcare workers in that community and two thirds by the community users living in that community. The second level would be a district level of 100,000 to 500,000, which would oversee a general hospital. So each community health board would elect two users and one worker to the district health board. And in the third level, which would represent 500,000 to 3 million, overseeing a regional medical center with specialized services and medical education for doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers and regional healthcare planning. And the regional board would consist of two users and one worker elected by the district boards. And then finally, there's the fourth level, the national or federal board, which would oversee the finances and the distribution of funds, mostly on a per capita basis to the lower levels, and provide overall planning to support medical research and the development of healthcare facilities. So one of the purposes of having this community-controlled, community-based national health service is that the community health boards would be given the resources to oversee a community health center, which would drive healthcare into communities that are excluded now, the disadvantaged communities primarily. So each community health center would have equal funding. And that won't happen in a centralized system where equal power and participation is not institutionalized for every community, including especially disadvantaged communities. Now, the Dellums bill clearly grew out of the New Left. He drew on a draft written by the Medical Committee for Human Rights, which was formed by doctors in the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project in 1964. And he drew on the work of the Health Policy Advisory Committee, or HealthPAC, which was based in New York City and sponsored by the Institute for Policy Studies, which I talked about earlier in relation to the public energy system. And it was HealthPAC that actually came up with the Great Leap Sideways critique of national health insurance. In fact, it was written by Barbara Ehrenreich, who many of you know recently passed away as one of these people out of the New Left who were involved in HealthPAC. So anyway, the point in going over these examples is to urge us to recover the New Left socialism as a really democratic socialism, you know, trying to realize the New Left's, you know, themes of participatory democracy and community control. So New Deal liberalism is not enough. And as I explained in some of these programs, even what looks like New Deal liberalism or is presented that way is really neoliberalism. You know, like the Inflation Reduction Act, the supposed climate program, which is full of subsidies for private sector clean energy, or the American Climate Corps grants program for nonprofits. This isn't even New Deal liberalism, let alone New Left socialism. And the key that, you know, we need to take away from this is we should be advocating public provision of goods and services through systems that are in power and are democratic, and empower all the communities, including disadvantaged communities. So the programs are accountable to the people, particularly disadvantaged people, who are often ignored or excluded from centralized public services. So I hope I made all that clear, but that's what I had to say. That it came out of our discussion. You can listen to the whole panel. It actually wasn't something I raised in my initial remarks, but it came out of a discussion. One of the participants in that was a guy named Eli Zaretsky, who came out of the New Left. He used to be a writer that I would read in a journal called Socialist Revolution in the early 1970s, which later became Socialist Review as the 60s subsided and people started toning things down, and we had this whole move to the right. And so those New Left policy proposals, I think, need to be recovered. So I'll stop there, and you know, I'm looking forward to your questions and comments. Frankie Lee, now that's what I'm definitely talking about. We definitely need public ownership and democratic control. I just was talking with Jill Stein about, you know, what to do about this terrible exploitation of people in Congo for the minerals, which is, there have been civil wars over this, you know, going on for about 25, 30 years. It's killed 6 million people. And, you know, this is a, you know, a tragedy that people don't talk about. So would nationalization be enough in Congo so they aren't so exploited? And the problem is the Congo already has partially nationalized its mining industry, mostly in joint ventures with Chinese corporations, but also corporations out of the United Kingdom. And so you get an interest in the bureaucratic, you call them the bureaucratic bourgeoisie in Congo, in profiting from this exploitation, along with the capitalists from China and the UK. Ironically, the US isn't so involved in this mining. It's ironic because we're involved with Belgium and the UK in having Patrice Lumumba assassinated in, I think it was 1960, maybe 61, because he was the first elected leader of Congo after it got independence, and he wanted to nationalize the resources and mining industries. And so we participated in getting rid of him, but we kind of cut out of the exploitation today. In any case, the point is public ownership with democratic worker and community control. Nova Dent, to avoid use of private corporations, would the government provide subsidies and support to unions working on projects for these various developments? Well, it wouldn't be subsidies, it would be ownership. And I guess you could call investment in building out these industries subsidies, but it's really investment because we're getting a return on our investment because these industries, you know, generate revenues, which instead of going to private capitalists would go to the public treasury. And yes, as part of these policies, we should have laws that protect unions' right to organize. And as we change from, say, fossil fuels to renewables, we've got to provide a just transition for those workers. So that would mean income and benefit guarantees as they make the transition to comparable work, and training programs to go along with that so they can get into the new renewable energy industry. Adam Clark Dent. I apologize, I'm jumping in and out, wrangling with the toddler for a nap. Understood. In my area, we have a lot of good hospitals with varying specializations. Thoughts on if each community would handle planning for more specialized facilities, or does that still get planned at a higher level under that plan? Specialized facilities would be at the regional level, which is 500,000 to 3 million people in the Dellums bill. Hospitals, general hospitals would be at the district level, which is 50,000 to 100,000 people. And wait a minute, I'm trying to remember, 50,000. So the second level would oversee the general hospitals, but specialized hospitals and regional medical centers would be at the third level, the regional level. And what would be added would be community health centers in every community of 25 to 50,000 people, so that everybody has, you know, ready access to outpatient care in their community. So I hope that answers it. You can look up online the Ron Dellums United States Health Service Act, which he carried from 1977 until he left Congress about 1997. And then Barbara Lee, who took his seat, continued with what she called the Josephine Butler United States Health Service Act, which Josephine Butler was a Black woman who was a big advocate for healthcare in the Black community. But the Lee bill, and I'm not sure which year this happened. I actually want to look that up because I'm working on something else where I want to find that out. But she reduced the Democratic control part to one small section, saying the national board would determine how worker and community representatives would be on the lower levels of local and regional. She didn't spell out like the Dellums bill did. Didn't even spell out that they'd be elected, so you could see them being appointed from the top down or by politicians at each level, which is not what we want. So one little question I have is, when did she change that from the Dellums bill, which was a step backwards? But anyway, look up the Dellums bill. It's not online that I can find, but there was a good article by Leonard Rodberg, who was one of these people in the early 70s that wrote this up. And I can't remember the exact title now, but it was talking about, it talked about a community-based national health service. I can't remember the formal title, sorry. Maybe when I finish writing this article where I'm going to go into this, I'll have that as one of the references. Yeah, it's in the chat, Bill 1798. That was Dellums' bill. The Lee bill, which, you know, carried on the concept, but in not such good form, was H.R. 3000. She kept it in the hopper until Obamacare passed, and then she stopped introducing it. So actually, I'm going to write a couple articles on this. One of them, which I'm writing for Capitol Hill Citizen, the publication Ralph Nader puts out, is challenging the progressives in Congress now to bring back the Dellums bill, which a number of leaders in the healthcare reform movement, from Physicians for a National Health Plan, called for in an article from March 31st, 2022, that appeared in The Nation called Medicare is Not Enough. And these are people who, in the mid-80s, during the Reagan era, a lot of these reformers from the New Left sort of threw in the towel, saying, you know, it's too conservative now. Maybe we can get what they have in Canada, which is national health insurance, what they call Medicare up there. And maybe doctors would be more amenable, because at least socializing the insurance process would make it simple for doctors. They just have to build this one system instead of, you know, scores and scores of health plans that they have to look through, see what the plan is willing to offer to pay for a service, and they bill for it, and then the plans often say, we're not going to pay, or we're only going to pay part of it. And so they spend a lot of time, you know, haggling over how they get paid. So national health insurance would enable doctors to focus on patient care instead of paperwork with the private insurance companies. So that's why they dropped the National Health Service and went to the national health insurance, what they called single payer, to get away from public and its socialist implications. And but now they're saying it's not enough, because what happened in the rest of the healthcare system, the hospitals, the clinics, the doctors, most doctors are employees of large corporations, ambulances, long-term care, nursing homes, pharmaceuticals, pharmacies. There's been enormous corporatization and monopolization of these markets. So the costs are rising, and it's feeding off the, it's raising the cost of healthcare, and it's undermining patient care by putting profits before patients. So that's why these doctors who in 86 compromised are now back saying, no, we got to go for the full National Health Service and bring back the Dellums bill. And so that's what I'm writing this article about. And I have a word limit, so I may write a longer one for Counterpunch or somebody. The email response to Representative Santos being expelled from Congress. Yeah, it was the right move. The guy, he was stealing from his contributors out of his, campaign fund. It was, well documented. The people opposed saying, well, first he has to be convicted. He's convicted himself. And this, report came back from that congressional committee, laid out the evidence. So good riddance. Ashley R., how does the Green Party specifically plan to address disability rights in relation to this and immigration? Well, disability rights, I mean, one of the things that the National Health Service would do is provide all medically necessary services. And that would include services that people with disabilities need. It also has provisions within the legislation for people to file grievances and get them dealt with. And with these locally elected boards, which in turn elect the district, regional, and national boards, you have an accountable structure, unlike in a centralized bureaucratic system where you phone in and you're going to get a telephone tree. And, they're going to refer you and take a long time to find a live person. And usually when you do, they can't deal with the problem. So I think, it will definitely be a better program for people with disabilities. In immigration, the National Health Service would provide services for anybody residing in the United States, regardless of their immigration status. So I hope that answers your question. Amy L. Sachs, was Stein able to pay off the wrongful penalties the feds levied against her before announcing her candidacy? I admit I haven't kept up on that, too busy. I believe she paid the major portion, if not all of it, and that it's not inhibiting her from going forward. And from what I've seen, like that online launch where she raised $14,000 in, after just a brief request for payment or for contributions, I think that's probably not an issue for her. So, I think that's good news. Vicki Corden, we need to keep corporations out of healthcare, and big pharma needs to stop bribing politicians. Yeah, one thing that, and we should probably put this in the links, Margaret Flowers and I wrote up a proposal for a community-controlled National Health Service that, was about implementing what the Dellums bill called for. And the thing, and Margaret did most of this work, is she laid out a 10-year plan. So we would first have national health insurance or Medicare for all immediately. And then over the next 10 years, we do the planning and research needed to build out the public healthcare system. So we would get hospitals and clinics where they're needed. We would transition healthcare workers to the public systems. And, that would require, research, planning, and then building it out. So she laid out a 10-year timeline. And what we did which the Dellums bill doesn't do, is we brought the pharmaceutical industry into this public healthcare system, which has become, since Dellums and those folks, you know, developing this plan in the 70s, has become a much bigger problem. I mean, big pharma is, talk about putting profits before patients. It's ridiculous what they're charging in this country. And, you know, we've had these inhibitions or prohibitions against negotiating with them over drug prices. Now we got partial negotiations, and we got a $35 a month limit on insulin. But, you know, that's why the halfway measures. Why not enable Medicare, like the VA can do, the Veterans Administration, which is a health service model, because they own their hospitals, their doctors are public employees, and they can negotiate drug prices. So vets get drugs a lot cheaper than the rest of us. And some of the federal government is so much captured by big pharma that they, you know, have been reluctant to allow, you know, Medicare, which is a big organization, to negotiate prices with big pharma. You know, other countries allow this. They pay about half what we do in Canada for the same drugs on average. And that's just, you know, it's why a for-profit healthcare system is a pay-or-die system. And if you can't afford to pay, you're going to die. And then I think I've told people on this podcast, maybe about 5 years ago, the guy living downstairs from me was having trouble meeting his utility bills, and he had to take a medicine for his kidneys. And so he decided in April to skip the medicine in order to pay down his utility bills, which had grown during the winter. And he died. He died because he couldn't afford the medicine. And, you know, that's just a case I happen to know personally, but it happens all the time. And, you know, this is just, is really criminal. So, you know, there's some things that we should provide as a right, like healthcare, and not make it something you only get if you can pay for it. And that includes the drugs that big pharma provides. Ashley R., I meant in terms of redefining disabled people's ability to immigrate or emigrate. Disability, like other human rights, should have no borders. I agree with that. I'm not familiar with the limitations on immigration or emigration for disabled people, but it doesn't surprise me given our inhumane immigration system in this country. So I guess what you're saying is people apply for status as residents here in the United States and can be barred because they're bringing in disabilities. And I guess the rationale would be then that's a burden on social services. You know, again, it's, you know, pay or die. And, you know, we should look at providing basic things like healthcare as a human right. Chris Blankenhorn, Illinois legislators approved weakening the state's moratorium on nuclear power to allow new modular reactors. Response. Yeah, well, the Illinois legislators are idiots. Nuclear costs more than renewables. So why are they promoting nuclear? And the new modular reactors, they're not new. They've been around since shortly after World War II, and they've never been preferred because they're less, the return on investment is smaller because you require more investment for X amount of power. And so you got to build more of them. This is just something the nuclear industry is always pushing to, you know, try to say that we're better than we used to be. But they're a damn disaster. You know, all the waste they've left behind that we don't know what to do with. The nuclear disasters we've had and are always possible with operating nuclear power plants. The costs, I mean, there's just no reason to go that way. And, you know, it's another case of, you know, an industry capturing the government. That's why not just the Illinois legislature, but the Biden administration is promoting nuclear and subsidizing it as a quote unquote clean energy. When it's dirty as hell, it may not release so much carbon dioxide, although it does through the whole fuel cycle and the construction process, but it's still dirty with all the nuclear waste, all that radiation that gets released, and it costs more. It just, you know, why do we do the stupid things? You know, back in the 50s, there was a commission called the Paley Commission. It was authorized by Truman and came to Eisenhower. And it was a study of what do we do after the oil runs out. They thought the oil was going to run out after World War II, you know, in the, you know, coming decades. So, you know, what should the energy bases be for the United States? And the Paley Commission concluded solar. And Eisenhower rejected that and went nuclear because the nuclear industry also fuels and provides the technology and the materials for nuclear weapons. So they called it the peaceful atom. And the whole propaganda thing, I don't know if people today have this, but when I was going to elementary school, we got My Weekly Reader, which was news about the world. And I remember reading in there what great things nuclear power, the peaceful atom, was going to do for us. And, you know, it sounded good to me until in my teens I got involved with the Sierra Club and then Friends of the Earth, which formed because the Sierra Club didn't oppose the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant in California, which we're still trying to close. So the nuclear industry tied to the military nuclear weapons industry is powerful. And so they're able to get these irrational decisions from legislatures like in Illinois, or administrations like the Biden administration. And before that, you know, Trump and Obama. You know, Obama's policy was all of the above, everything from solar panels to nuclear power plants. It's and that's what industry wants. And industry's captured the government. Response to Kissinger's death. Man, why did that guy get to live to 100? I mean, he was a very callous, mean-spirited man. I mean, the death of ordinary people didn't really matter to him. He's what he called himself, a foreign policy realist, and his perspective was, you know, the world should be divided between the great powers and their spheres of influence, and that's just the way it is. Accept it. So if you're a small country that's being colonized, occupied, invaded, but you're in the sphere of influence of that country, then, you know, just live with it. That's what he told the Ukrainians, you know, when the Russians invaded. He was saying, you know, cut a deal, let Russia have some a piece of Ukraine. And it's the same, you know, way he, you know, related to the Soviet Union, China, the way he treated the Palestinians in the Middle East. It is just a immoral, callous foreign policy. And Kissinger epitomized it. And a lot of the things he did, I mean, he couldn't go some places because some of the international laws against violations of the laws of war and humanitarian law have universal jurisdiction. So some countries will use their courts to indict people and, you know, bring them to justice if they show up in the country. So Kissinger couldn't go everywhere in the world because of that. And, you know, too bad he wasn't brought before an international criminal court. But, you know, again, good riddance. Not sorry to see that guy go. Chris Blankenhorn, unfortunately, his ideas were adopted by both major parties and live on. Yeah, that realism, you know, sometimes we have things like the Leahy Amendment, which says that we can't provide weapons that violate human rights, but then we don't implement it, like with, you know, Israel. Israel's totally violating the human rights of Palestinians, and we provide them, you know, we've been providing $3.8 billion a year in military aid Obama got, I think it was a 10-year deal, which we're still in the middle of. And now we're adding another $14.3 billion, sending them weapons, including 2,000-pound bunker busters, which are just leveling, you know, cities in Gaza. So what I'm saying is there is a wing of Congress that wants our foreign policy to be based on human rights, even sometimes gets laws passed, but then it's violated. You know, back in the 70s, when we had the so-called Vietnam syndrome, we got a law passed against aiding death squads of right-wing governments in Central America. And of course, you know, the Reagan administration went around that, the Iran-Contra controversy. And then we had another law not aiding, not intervening or aiding South African apartheid in its fight against liberation movement in Angola. But we know now that, you know, behind the scenes, the CIA and military intelligence were providing support for the South Africans against the Angolans. So what we really do need is a foreign policy based on promoting democracy and human rights, which the corporate interests that control the government really don't want. They have no problem with repressive governments that make labor cheap and don't enforce or have environmental regulations so they can loot and pollute without consequence. So again, you know, both major parties, you're right about that, and that's why we need a Green Party. And the hour went by fast again. I talked a little longer than usual, but I hope that explanation of the differences between neoliberalism, New Deal liberalism, and New Left socialism got across. And I think I'll be writing some stuff about that. So if and when I do, I'll make sure people here know. So like I said at the beginning, the main thing we can do right now is get out in these street demonstrations supporting a ceasefire, write your members of Congress, do everything you can, because this is a genocide going on right before our eyes. And we all got to do our part. And then, you know, with the climate summit going on, like I said, I don't think world leaders are going to lead us out of this problem without a lot of pressure from below by a climate movement that, like I said, needs to raise its expectations. So that's where Greens come in. And we need to make at least the Democrats compete for the climate vote in these upcoming elections. So there's plenty for all of us to do. And I hope everybody has a good week, and we'll be back here next Saturday.